This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. And this is Arizona History. Today's reading is from the book titled Tucson Memories, written by Bonnie Henry and published in 2006. This topic is Holidays, Article Number 6, Christmas Miracles. This is a story of a Christmas miracle, a snowfall that couldn't be, and a cat named Tuffy, who truly was. In the waning hours of December 23, 1941, Richard Wood, then age 9, was fast asleep. Not far above him, a four-engine bomber with 19 men aboard was silently gliding through the icy air, heading for an emergency landing in what was then called Davis-Monthan Field. "I assume I didn't hear it because no mortars were going," said Wood, who also soundly slept through the ensuing crash, "right through the roof of a house less than 2 blocks away." Wood, who would grow up to be a meteorologist, figured it was ice on the wings. "It probably iced up on the approach to DM," he said. The plane struck 2 power poles before hitting the 4-room adobe house. Its right wing sheared off the upper half of the home, causing it to collapse. Inside were 4 people who had just retired for the night: a Mr. and Mrs. Osborne Otteson, a Mrs. T.E. Callaghan, and her 3-year-old child. Here's where the miracle comes in. None suffered so much as a scratch, save for Mr. Otteson, who was treated for minor injuries. What's more, while several of the crew had fractures and other injuries, none was life-threatening. Yet another survivor would be pulled from the still-crumbling home early that Christmas Eve morn: Tuffy, the family cat, rescued by Private David Lindsay of 32nd Air Base Squadron. "I don't know who was scared the most, Tuffy or me," Lindsay would tell Star reporters. When young Wood woke up that morning at his Midtown home on East Pima Street, he found one more miracle outside his window: snow. During the night, the first snow of any merit since 1937 had blanketed Tucson. "We had 2 or 3 inches," said Wood. Naturally, the next day's papers were filled with stories about the crash. There was also a short story about the snowfall, rather cryptically written, in parentheses, censored: "Blankets Tucson for first time since 1937, ran the Christmas Day headline. Beneath it, all mention of snow also drew the word censored, along with this explanation: "Since wartime regulations have inhibited the dissemination of any information regarding the weather, the substance which local residents discovered upon their lawns and housetops when they arose yesterday morning must remain a military secret." The story went on to describe children engaging in censored fights and building censored men. "It was just 3 weeks after World War II broke out," said Wood. "I remember asking my mother what war means." He soon found out, at least on the home front. The next year, the family moved to Southern California, where Wood's widowed mother and brother-in-law found work in the defense plants. The family later moved to Washington, D.C. In 1973, Wood returned to Tucson, heading up its National Weather Service office until 1980. Following assignments in Maryland and Albuquerque, he retired to Tucson in 1987. From 1988 to 1992, he wrote a weekly weather column for the Star, including one, of course, about the censored snow. Later, Wood became editor of the Gale Group Weather Almanac and Weather of U.S. Cities. A lot of Decembers have come and gone since then, but he never forgot Christmas Eve 1941 and its many miracles. The next section is titled The More Things Change. Article Number 1. Water, water everywhere. A flick of the fingers, a turn of the wrist, and there you have it. Cool, clean water. All you want. And all taken for granted. Yea, though we live in the desert. It's a good bet, however, that such nonchalance was rare among those who preceded us in this valley, 100 years or so ago. But then, that's what usually happens when you buy your water from a leather bag strung across the back of some burrow. The burrows, filled up, at El Ahuente, or Little Ice Springs, Tucson's principal source of water, gurgling just west of a more recent Tucson landmark, the Wishing Shrine on South Main Avenue. Even before the falls of the Presidio went up in 1775, El Ahuito was here, slaking the thirst of everyone from Father Kino to Captain Juan Bautista d'Anza. Once the Americanization of Tucson began following the Gadsden Purchase in 1854, the springs became even more crucial to a town with few private wells. Mornings would find several burros lined up at the springs, each waiting its turn. Water vendors would then lead the burros through the streets of town, crying agua for sale. By the late 1870s, the burro had been supplanted by progress. In this case, a wooden water cart also lined with animal skins to hold the precious liquid. Owned by two entrepreneurs, Joe Fye and Adam Saunders, the cart rolled down the same rutted streets where once the burros had clopped. Nickel a bucket was the going rate, payable upon delivery or else at the end of the week. Water vendors simply penciled the tab on the door jams. Erasures, it was reported, were few. Needless to say, few of the precious drops were wasted on laundry, shrubbery, or the human body. Hence the public bathhouses to the north of Little Ice Springs. Known first as Simpson's Baths and later as Spring Garden, the baths, which were also operated in later years by Fye and Saunders, proved a more sociable alternative to the usual Saturday night spit-in-a-rag routine. From former Arizona Daily Star reporter and historian Bernice Koshluk comes a description of the baths. Customers who waited their turns to pay 25 cents for a bath could sit on benches under the trees in the patio as their children swayed in swings. In a small building, there was a boiler under which a fire constantly burned to heat the water. A series of bathhouses was nearby, each with a small rooms just large enough for zinc or tin tubs, pegs for clothes and towels, and a shelf for soap and collar buttons. Partitions did not interrupt conversations, and the latest gossip flowed more freely than the few buckets of water allotted each customer. There were no social barriers among those who used the bath. Prominent families gathered there with whiskey-soaked miners who had come in from the hills for a prolonged spree. Cowboys and legislators steamed the alcohol from their bodies, and soldiers just back from a campaign against the Apaches relaxed their saddle-weary muscles. The town's first piped-in water arrived at 4 p.m. September 16, 1882, after a valve on Main Street was opened and a 6-inch stream came bursting forth, reported the next day's Star, which went on to rapidize. We may truly say that Tucson has witnessed the third great event in her steady, solid growth. First, the railroad, then artificial light by gas. But the crowning event, that which will make pleasant homes surrounded by shrubbery, lawns, and gardens, is the grand water supply, which brings health and its many attending advantages. Events leading up to that momentous occasion actually began a year earlier, when Sylvester Waltz set up a water farm and pumping system on the banks of the Santa Cruz River. Wells were sunk in the land, and a wooden flume in the bed of the river sped the water to town. A year after Tucson first experienced the marvel of piped-in water, Bettina Steinfeld, Albert's wife, became the first in town to own a bathtub with running water. But as any student of plumbing knows, what's piped in must eventually be piped out. By the late 1890s, Tucsonians were beginning to tire of stepping around what was routinely flowing down the streets of town. City fathers, taking note, created a water and sewage commission to, as they say, look into the problem. Not everyone, however, recognized that there was indeed a problem, as Tucson pioneer Mose Drockman recounted in his memoirs. Strange as it may seem, some of our prominent citizens were opposed to the installation of a sewer system. I remember one in particular. His argument was that he did not want a sewer. He had just completed a very fine cesspool. The conditions here in the city were deplorable, as one can imagine. Think of a town of 4,000 or 5,000 without a sewer system. In spite of opposition, we finally got a sewer put down Congress Street. Then we started out to get one on Stone Avenue. Again, we ran into opposition from people who owned corner property. They said they had already a sewer on Congress Street, and what did they want with one on Stone Avenue? We were constantly fighting over these public improvements. Well, the city got its sewer system all right. It also got the water company. On July 24, 1900, Tucson Water Company, still owned by Watts and Mr. H. A. Lawton, became the City of Tucson Water Works. Price tag, $110,000. As the time of the sale, the company had 225 customers who paid an average monthly bill of $2. When Tucson began its sewer system, also in 1900, raw sewage irrigated grain crops around what is now Horry Park. the town's first sewage treatment plant was still 28 years away. Just as we had effluent back then, we also had water conservation. Despite the stars glowing, oasis in the desert predictions, the town water supply, or rather its inadequate pumping capacity, soon brought forth some rather ominous-sounding conservation measures. Arizona Daily Star, August 4, 1916's headline, "Mayor is going after those who waste water. Police instructed to keep eyes peeled for all-night irrigators." 13 years earlier, on June 19, 1903, the Star also reported what may have been the first Beat the Peak campaign, as citizens were urged to sprinkle and irrigate only between the hours of 5 and 8 a.m. and p.m. By 1909, the trend begun by Bettina Steinfeld and her bathtub was also having its effect. Reported the Star, "People who take baths cause a drain much greater than is believed." So great was the problem of excess water use that residents were ordered to turn off their faucets whenever the fire whistle blew. As of 1921, the list of water customers had grown to the point that the city was forced to hire a second meter reader, part-time, with the stipulation that the rest of the employees' time would be spent repairing city cars. Disputes over rate hikes, some as much as 50%, also occurred during the late 1920s, leading one city attorney to give this legal opinion. City water was not bound to do so for a uniform or reasonable price, but had the right to charge all it could get. Today, it's the county rather than the city that administers our sewer system. As for what comes out of our faucets, we've come a long way from the burrows with the water bags. Article number 2, direct dialing. You say you don't own a computer, your TV doesn't come with remote control, and you have no idea how to send email? Never mind. You're still more technologically adroit than the entire population of Tucson 60 years ago. Before 1949, the only way to make a phone call in this burg was to give the operator your number. Then direct dialing hit town. Think learning a new computer system is scary? Try dialing your own. So daunting was the task that the phone company held an open house, complete with dial-your-own lessons. The Tucson Kiwanis and Optimists also got detailed demos during their luncheons. Witness this account in the January 6, 1949 Star, with phone company educator Marguerite Lupton using a large phone dial mock-up in front of some obviously worried optimists. Miss Lupton step-by-step explained how to use a dial, translating her words into action by dialing the massive dial on the giant model. Lifting the receiver, Miss Lupton got and called attention to the normal dial tone. The next move is to dial the number you want, being careful to permit the dial to return to neutral after each of the 5 digits. As she twirled each digit, the demonstrator lit up right across the board. Miss Lupton and her demonstrator must have been mighty busy, for the Star noted future appearances in schools, other civic groups, and wherever large groups gathered to learn the intricacies of the dial system. Fresh hell would follow. By the mid-50s, Tucsonians were getting lettered prefixes, swelling their phone numbers from 5 to 7 digits. Among the useless bits of minutiae still stuck in my brain is my parents' old number, MA3-8035. Never mind that just a few years later, those prefixes were phased out in favor of the 7-digit numbers we have today. Results? Lots of Tucsonians wound up with new numbers. Not so, however, for those at the Dalton residence. "I'm guessing we had the same number since 1947, said Estelia Dalton, who found the earliest listing in a 1949 phone book. When I called up the phone company to ask them how long the line had been in use, they said they didn't have the records anymore. It was Estelia's aunt, Dora Dalton, who had first put the line in their Barrio Anita home. Back then, the outside world came ringing in on her basic black phone. We have weathered boyfriends, girlfriends, fire, threatening calls, obscene calls, and never changed the numbers, said Estelia, who moved back to the house a few years ago to care for her ailing aunt. After my aunt passed away, I asked to keep the same phone number, Estelia said. The phone company charged her $50 for the privilege. Alas, the black phone is no more. In 1974, the wiring gave out, Estelia said. They didn't have the parts anymore. Later, her phone would be beige, with buttons. Incidentally, the Arizona Weekly Star, as today's Star was then known, installed its first telephone the same year phone service came to town, 1881. Teenage boys handled the switchboard. Apparently none had been schooled in customer service. For while lauding the progressive spirit of the times, the Star also shot this warning across its editorial bow. We take this occasion to caution the operator that we don't stand any backtalk when it's becoming our painful duty to admonish him. Good grief! No wonder we went to dial phones. Article 3. Marjorie Long. Her name is synonymous with putting roofs over people's heads. Yet her mother's first home in Tucson was a tent, and a rather humble one at that. My grandfather sent for my grandmother and the two kids. One was my mother, and they pitched a tent at what is now a park on 4th Avenue south of Speedway, said Marjorie Long. Yes, that's Long, as in Long Realty, founded by her father-in-law, Roy H. Long, in 1926. 2 years earlier, Marjorie was born into a family whose own roots in Tucson stretch back to the early 1900s. Grandfather Burton Bovey, a tubercular from Pennsylvania, arrived in 1901. Not long after, he sent for his family, wife Catherine, infant son Daniel, and daughter Clara, age 2. Soon, Burton Bovey signed on with the fledgling Desert Laboratory atop Tumamoc Hill. Mother said there wasn't one side of the Tucson Mountains or the Lower Catalinas that he didn't explore. He discovered a number of species of cactus. By then, the family had abandoned the tent for a house on West Congress Street. Meandering close by was the still-wet Santa Cruz, where young Daniel would gather watercress along the banks. Objective? Sales to the working girls in Tucson's red light district. My uncle used to say that money put him through dental school, said Marjorie. In 1923, her father, Clarence Perrin, married her mother, Clara. 9 months and 5 days later, I was born. On her first birthday, her father, then working for the Southern Pacific Railroad, passed the Arizona State Bar exam. You didn't need to go to law school then, said Marjorie. Hers was a small-town childhood at its best. Home was the southwest corner of Stone Avenue and Helen Street. Chickens scratched and rabbits scurried in the backyard. Meanwhile, the whole world rolled down Stone Avenue. I used to put a purse tied with a string in the middle of the road, then hide behind a tree, said Marjorie. When drivers circled back for a closer look, she'd yank on the string. She remembered Indians rumbling into town, wagons loaded with wood and baskets for sale. Then there were the picnic lunches, munched under the mulberry trees in the park at Stone Avenue and Speedway. I never worried about safety. I'd walk home from the U of A at night through that park. In the spring of 43, her first year at the University of Arizona, she met Barry Long. They courted for a time before he left for military training. That summer, Marjorie also signed up for the war effort, working the swing shift as a mechanics helper at Ryan Field. She and Barry married in 44, just before he shipped off to the European Theater as a combat engineer. She went to work in the SP's dispatch office. Barry came back, got his civil engineering degree, and began building houses in boomtown Tucson. When his father retired in 52, he took over the real estate company. They had one office and five salespeople, said Marjorie, who raised four sons, Russell, Randy, Stephen, and Roy H. Long II. In 1980, Barry retired and the couple moved to the Wilcox area where they grew apples, thousands of them. It was a wonderful time, but it was a money guzzler, said Marjorie. By 1994, they were back in town, where Marjorie earned her real estate license. Barry, who rejoined her in the business, died in 1998. Like many long-timers, she cherished the town that was, but she also looked to the future. Tucson's a wonderful place, but you can't keep standing still, she said, or live in a tent. Article 8, Gem and Mineral Show. They unstopped the toilets, strung their own lights, and guarded the gems with a shotgun, all inside a drafty old Quonset hut, and that was after the event had proved to be a roaring success. The first year's show was held in a school cafeteria. After all the bills were paid, we came in about $10 ahead. The janitor was working for free, so we gave it to him. Those were the words of Betty Cottle, who along with her husband Dan helped start up what the whole world now knows as the Tucson Gem and Mineral Show, an event that pumps millions of dollars each year into the local economy while luring visitors from just about every country with rocks. It began, of all places, in Phoenix. In January of 1955, Dan and Betty Cottle, members of the then 8-year-old Tucson Gem and Mineral Society, were attending a gem and mineral show in Phoenix. There, they met up with gem and mineral dealer Bob Roots, who urged them to start a gem show in Tucson. "He said he would line up all the dealers," said Dan, who became chairman of Tucson's first show. The Cottles, along with fellow rockhounds Harold Rupert and Clayton Gibson, managed to talk the Tucson Gem and Mineral Society into sponsoring the show, as long as none of the society's money was used, that is. The organizing committee got permission to hold the 2-day affair in the cafeteria of Helen Keeling Elementary School. "Our kids went there," said Betty. The school's parents group also offered to sell refreshments. With just a few weeks to plan it all out, members hurriedly cobbled together a few glass display cases. The rest of the cases were borrowed from accommodating shop owners around town. Betty was in charge of publicity. "I made up signs and put them in every store window in Tucson," she said. Then she hit the airwaves. "I went on some radio show with a big bag of Apache tears and said any parents of kids who wanted to come to the show could get one. That drew a lot." The show, featuring displays of fewer than a dozen dealers, was free, of course. Despite rainy weather, close to 1,500 attended the 2-day event. "We had so many people, we knew we had to have it somewhere else the next year," said Betty. The Tucson Gem and Mineral Society also agreed to fund the show from then on. The next year, they set up shop in what then passed for the town's only exhibition hall, a Quonset hut out on the Pima County Fairgrounds on South 6th Avenue. There was no heat, it was cold, the toilets were always stopping up, and the roof leaked, said Dan. Not only that, existing ceiling lights were woefully inadequate when it came to illuminating the brilliant mineral displays down below. "We had no money, so we bought aluminum foil-shaped reflectors, strung wire, and hung light bulbs out every case," said Dan, a retired electrician. Everyone pitched in, covering the walls with butcher paper to hide the dirt and kick marks, dusting the cases, sweeping floors, and working on the plumbing. Security was all in-house as well. "I took my shotgun, locked the doors, and slept there for several years in a row," said Dan. As for refreshments, the Keeling's parents group moved its food operation to the hut, where it would continue every year until 1972. "All the profits went to the school," said Dan. About 2,500 swarmed the 2-day show in 1956, its second year in operation. "The third year, we charged 25 cents," said Betty. The membership thought that was outrageous, but even bigger crowds showed up. Still, it was years before more than the front half of the Quonset hut was needed. But as the show grew, more and more dealers and wholesalers clamored for space. One year, and one year only, the show committee responded to that demand by renting out the nearby cow barn. "We went in and raked out all the manure and cleaned the stalls, but what we didn't bargain for was the green sawdust that covered the floor 4 inches deep," said Bill Schwab, who along with his wife Millie chaired the show for several years. Some of the displays were more curious and valuable. In 1957, Erna Clark set a dinner of rocks, explained Millie. "They're rocks that look like food. They're common." Less common was Mary Aspis and her singing rocks, which also drew the crowds of several years. "She was quite unique," said Millie. "She collected rocks and broke them for the tones. The rocks were then played, somewhat like a xylophone." Glittery showstoppers started cropping up as well, including a $2 million display of diamonds shown off during the 1965 event. 4 years earlier, it was emeralds that stole the show. "They were worth $40,000, said Bill. "I kept them under the bed for 2 weeks." The real turning point for the show, however, came not in mineral but rather in human form, also back in 61. That was the year the show's organizers were able to snare a visit by Paul DeSantis, then assistant curator of mineralogy at the Smithsonian Institution. "We got a list of museums with mineral collections and wrote them," said Millie. "We offered to pay travel and exhibit expenses. Paul DeSantis wrote back and said we were the only ones to ever do that." Actually, expense money was so short that DeSantis wound up bunking with the Shups and using Millie's old car for transportation. No matter. For year after year, he returned to Tucson, bringing with him cases of minerals for display, giving lectures and judging competitive events. More importantly, he told the rest of the world about this marvelous little gem and mineral show being held every winter in a Quonset hut in the middle of the desert. By 1969, DeSantis was describing Tucson's exhibition as the New York Stock Exchange of the mineral world. That sort of talk soon had other heavyweights of the mineral world flocking to the show as well. Among them, Peter Embry, curator of the British Museum of Natural History, who was allowed to bring along an exhibit from the museum, something never before permitted. "I had to call London at 3 a.m. and talk to the Board of Trustees to get permission," said Dan. "They said he could bring only what he could hand carry." Despite the warm Western hanging by members of the Tucson vigilantes upon his arrival, Embry, too, returned year after year. Curators from various museums in France, Denmark, Spain, Russia, and China also started making their trek to Tucson. "Now we have so many curators of museums coming here that they schedule their own meetings," said Betty. In 1971, the show put up its glass cases for the last time in the dust of the old Quonset hut. "It had gotten so crowded that our 20-foot aisles had gone into 10 feet," said Dan. But the crowds were even more intense the following year, the show's first in the new Tucson Community Center. Seems a people-pleaser was the Tucson Ring meteorite, a 1,400-pound meteorite that had plunged to Earth near Tucson, but had been housed at the Smithsonian since 1863. "It drew such a mob of people that you couldn't even walk the floor," said Dan. "People were saying they wouldn't come back the next year." But of course they did, and the year after that as well. Today, the little endeavor that began in elementary school cafeteria is touted by many as the largest gem and mineral show in the world. Others are not so sure, citing a similar show in Munich, Germany. Betty Cottle, however, entertains no such doubt about who's number one in the world of gem and mineral shows. "We have a friend who is coming back from Europe who saw a sign about that Munich show in an airport there. The sign said," Betty was billing the Munich show as the Tucson of Europe. This is Melissa, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona.